A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And this is the New Statesman podcast. You know, I don't even have the capacity in me, Stephen, to start with saying, do we have to talk about Europe? Because we're never going to talk about anything else ever again on the New Statesman podcast.
No, we are about to embark on effectively a prolonged series of divorce negotiations. I mean, it will be the biggest legal undertaking in the history of...
history.
The world. I mean, literally, like... The one group of people who you can categorically say will do very well out of this vote are lawyers.
I was thinking about the hatred of faceless bureaucrats, and I was thinking, actually, it's been to be a civil servant, this is prime time. Anyway, we're joined by our editor, Jason Cowley, who I think has had the advantage of slightly more sleep than me and Stephen, who are becoming slightly delirious. Let's just look through, because there are some patterns that you can pick out of the results, right? So... Jason, it seemed to me, I mean, there will be lots of ways that people will try and slice these results, old versus young, south versus north, or, you know, big cities versus rural areas. Which of those are interesting, do you think? And actually, which of those are productive to reflect on?
Well, hi, Helen. I actually didn't have much sleep, so I'm as delirious as you guys are. First point, really, Scotland. Overwhelmingly for Remain. I think every district voted to remain in the European Union.
But on low turnouts, which I thought was interesting. I mean, there were many moments when I thought, oh, God, this has gone badly wrong. Sunderland being when that came through, and that was as a bad result. But also turnout in Glasgow was, 52%?
Yeah, but some of my contacts in Scotland said actually for a long time it was considered to be England's referendum. And there wasn't the same kind of engagement in Scotland that they had, certainly, of course, for the independence referendum in 2014 when they had a turnout of, 85%. So... the union seems to me to be imperiled. And then you've got this really disturbing split or division or whatever we call it between what you might call metropolitans and the rest. And that is so marked and so significant, I think.
But that, I mean, again, I think that's an interesting one. Because so when Philip Cowley did the breakdown of different types of people, their metropolitan liberal elite, they reckon to be 8% of the country, didn't they? Whereas, you know, the actual Remain vote is 48%. So it isn't just London do-gooders or Bristol kind of do-gooders, is it?
But
where did the other votes for Remain come from?
It's actually all of the types of people who live in most big cities. I think the interesting known unknown, as it were, is we don't really understand what it is about Birmingham. The only, no offence, listeners from Sheffield and Salford, but I'm afraid Sheffield and Salford are not cities in a global sense. They're large towns. If you went to someone in the parts I'm from would describe Sheffield as a city, they go, are you sure? Yeah, but like all of the places which we would recognise as cities, with the exception of Birmingham, voted to remain. So even places which are technically not cities because they don't have a cathedral.
Worcester voted to leave. It's my gaffe.
Yeah, Southampton voted for leave, which is also technically a city.
But Reading,
but they're not
which is,
big
is,
urban centres.
Yeah,
sorry.
Reading, which is in every sense actually a city, voted to remain.
But I think, I mean, not no offence to Reading, and this is now Reading people, right? I see that as a sort of satellite commuter belt for London, right? I mean, and I think that's a big... I imagine rural Berkshire has got a very different voting profile to...
Yeah, but I think the thing is that In basically most cities, A, trend younger. They tend to be more politically informed. So I mean, so
it's a lot easier to canvass in a city. I mean, in a really brutal way. You know, you think that Rory Stewart, who's got a constituency that's in the middle of nowhere in the Pennines, sort of talked about walking hundreds of miles at the last, you know, to try and actually just cover the ground.
He's got Whitelaw's old seat, hasn't he, up on the borders, up in the Lake District, I think.
Yeah, much easier to canvass Stoke Newington.
Yeah. But, to take Liverpool, which is why it is not quite as simple, although obviously classes, as always in politics, pretty much, you know, the kind of sine qua non, as it were. But in Liverpool, people are very aware of what the EU has done for the city. And I think that is something about cities themselves, and they are kind of pedagogic.
I think one of the most interesting results this morning is Cornwall saying, we were promised this 60 million a year of EU funding. We're still getting that right, mm-hmm. despite having voted by, I think, 56% in favour of Leave. I mean, you know, I never heard that promise made explicitly by the Leave campaign. Perhaps they did in targeted advertising to Cornish people themselves. But there is a slight sense this morning of people didn't think, some of the kind of people who voted for Leave didn't think they're the kind of people whose voices get taken seriously. They are not. I think protest vote is over-egging it. But there does seem to be a slight element of surprise that it's actually happened amongst some people.
Yes, also a lot of people were mobilised to vote because they feel deeply distressed, disaffected, whatever the word is. I mean, the turnout was significant in many what you might call traditional working class Labour towns, you know, the small towns of England. Huge votes for out, defying the party's recommendations, defying their leader. I mean, extraordinary results in the northeast of England, the east coast, the Midlands.
Yeah, and in Harlow, your old place, where it was very. I mean, those.
But that's no surprise.
But the turnouts, I thought, were extraordinary in some of those areas. Turnouts of 75%.
Yes, Harlow, Basildon, Brentwood, all of these Essex and Kent satellite towns.
So the most Brexity place in Britain is Boston in Lincolnshire, which also has, I think, the highest rate of immigration from Eastern Europe. The most Remain place is, unsurprisingly, Gibraltar, where I think something like 93 people. I think it was one of those ones like that Falklands referendum, where you could probably kind of get all those people in a large boat or something. Let's just talk a bit about Wales, Stephen, which I know is a country that you're interested in. I think that what that result does in Wales, which is, you know, so 7 UKIP assembly members at the last election.
Yeah.
And actually not a great, you know, Labour won it at the general election. Not a great result for Remain there.
Yeah, it was a devastating vote for Remain, really. I mean, so the referendum was won and lost through, but it was, if you look at somewhere where it was lost, it was probably lost in Wales, in that it was the place where that city bonus was slightly weaker for Remain. It was the place where, I think the Vale of Glamorgan is the only kind of fairly leafy place and actually behaved like a leafy place outside of Wales. And as I've said before on this podcast, there has been a long-standing building up of Eurosceptic and anti-immigration sentiment in Wales, including places like Ebbw Vale, where there are literally, where, you know, when I visited, I increased by 100% the minority population there. So places where immigration is not really something which actually is happening. Yeah. But it is a testament to the political skill of Harwin Jones. A lot of people in the Labour Party were very angry about his decision not to start canvassing for the referendum until after
The May elections.
Personally, to be honest, I think Brexit is a far bigger catastrophe for everyone in
Welsh
Britain,
hill farmers,
but particularly, you know, Welsh hill farmers, people in economically deprived rural areas. But in terms of winning those assembly seats, that was probably the right call.
Yeah, but if it's a catastrophe, why don't the people perceive it as being so? Why have so many of them voted, if you're to be believed, against their own interests?
Well, 11 million people voted for failed austerity twice in a row. I mean, Margaret, the Conservatives won 4 elections on the bounce in the.
That's quite Olympian dismissal of all of these people who feel utterly let down disenchanted. The status quo is not working for them. That's what they think. And this is what the Labour Party has fundamentally misunderstood for too long.
I think that group of people does exist.
I mean, but also, what I would ultimately, say is that in terms of misunderstanding people, I'm going to like do a little song and dance of being the only person in this office who consistently said, and I thought, and Britain's EU membership was in trouble. So
actually,
I think,
apart from last week's podcast,
when I allowed everyone else's whatever to go me.
Well, I thought, you know, I thought
optimism.
That Cameron had steadied the ship, and people had, were not feeling that. You know, they'd felt there was a period of unpleasant economic times, and they felt they were coming out of that. And I thought that would have essentially triumphed over it. But I think, Jason, I think those people do exist, and actually, I have an enormous amount of sympathy with them. I have less sympathy with older, comfortable middle class people who have voted Leave for reason. You know, actually, we've seen a lot of people in areas without high immigration who are, you know, who don't live in places that are. I think if you live in Boston in Lincolnshire, then yes, actually, on you know, every day you're seeing the effects of high immigration in your town. But I think that's only a chunk of the
no, I agree with you. I feel profoundly sorry for millennials, young people aged sort of 18 to 24, 26, overwhelmingly voted for Remain. And people much older than them, the baby boomers who have benefited from the welfare state, free education, house price inflation, they turn around and say, we're out. Meanwhile, their children and their grandchildren are left behind in what may turn out to be a really peculiar rump state.
And going to universities that now will have much more difficulty attracting staff from the rest of the EU, you know, that places that are doing science research that will now have far more difficulty getting funding because you need to do cross-EU projects.
Oh, but we'll have the Australian-based point system, Helen.
Everything, well, hallelujah. Which I think George points out means that Australia actually has more immigration per capita than us. And additionally to that, has an phenomenally cruel and inhumane, I mean, anyone who would point to that system as one to model is pointing to wanting people turned back in boats and wanting kept in camps.
As you know, I'm a Eurosceptic. I was never an outer. But look at the consequences today. A collapsing pound, markets in turmoil, Gerry Adams coming out calling for a United Ireland, Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond calling for a second independence referendum, resignation of the Prime Minister, an attempt to topple the Labour leader. I mean, this is extraordinary.
Yeah, I think it's been... Well, that's the one country that you touched a little bit on Ireland and Northern Ireland there. That's something that we had in the magazine and Gordon Brown's guest at it about the number of people who are Irish citizens, 500,000 of them who are living in the UK. Their status is now uncertain. Equally, the concept of, and Stephen, you wrote about this, of now a land border between somewhere that might very well be a free movement area and somewhere in Northern Ireland that we just don't know. We don't know or not what we're going to negotiate about that for the first time.
Yes, particularly because... One of the things that Vote Leave did that was tactically, of course, fairly astute, which was to major on immigration. But ultimately, the version of Brexit where you control your borders is also the most economically disastrous because you lose access to the single market. And in terms of the maintenance of the peace process in Ireland, it is the most catastrophic because it throws the Common Travel Agreement into doubt, which is part of the Lisbon Treaty. How could you have you then presumably have to have a fairly firm land border between the two to truly have border control, or you effectively cut Northern Ireland off from the United Kingdom.
Yeah, and the same thing with an independent Scotland, right? If that's then is part of a free movement zone, then you know that we have to rebuild Hadrian's Wall. It seems astonishing that those kind of things got so little airtime during the campaign. Jason, I know you've always been interested in England and Englishness. This, well, like you say, there are people in Scotland who felt this was England's referendum. The end result of this could be basically just England and Wales being what's left of the UK, right?
Yeah, I think so. Particularly if Scotland has that second referendum, and if they do, I expect it to be a vote for independence this time round. And I personally, as a unionist, and I would find it very hard to say to Scotland, well, you've got to stay within the United Kingdom when you've been dragged out of the European Union against your wishes. I mean, very difficult to say that.
And accept Tory governments that you don't vote for.
And also Tory governments of a particularly far-right ideological kind, in alliance with Nigel Farage's UKIP. I mean, that's not a David Cameron One Nation Conservative Party. So the English question, you know, who are the English? What do they want? This is a nation of more than 50 million people, an ancient nation. And one argument has always been that the English or Englishness is somehow lost in or coterminous with Britishness. And what would it be to stand apart from... the rest of the United Kingdom, and that's something we're going to be exploring, obviously, in the weeks ahead. Is this an eruption of English nationalism?
That's what I find difficult about it. I think when you say British, to me, that doesn't have the sort of racial implications. I feel Englishness is really coded as white.
I don't think so. I think there have been attempts to code Englishness as white. I mean, one saw that particularly in the '80s with football hooligans. And NF racist, but I don't think so. Englishness is very porous and open, as indeed is Britishness, and there's no reason why it can't be a civic identity rather than something rooted in blood and soil.
Let's quickly turn to the kind of party ramifications. First of all, so Cameron has set out his timetable for departure. He will be gone by the October Tory Party conference. Stephen, is your sense that anyone can stop Boris Johnson?
Hostage to fortune here, because I have spoken to maybe five Conservative MPs since it happened, most of whom were very much from the Remain side, so we kind of talked about Britain's fraught future rather than the Conservative Party's fraught future. But my instinct is no, because you have a group of Conservative MPs who'd kind of banked on the Osborne meal ticket and thought that was their path to prosperity. Osborne is obviously politically dead. It's like a headless chicken. He might still be running, but the body is dead. Those MPs are going to look for a safe haven, rather like the currency markets are right now with the pound, and their safe haven is probably going to be Boris. He looks inevitable. It may even be that Theresa May doesn't challenge him, because why would you? The Conservatives have done this before. It feels a lot like Suez. You had an old Etonian prime minister, a foreign policy disaster that weakened Britain forever. Forever. I mean, that was what we always talk about, a permanent diminution of Britain's internal prosperity and its ability to influence climate change and global security overseas forever. And what Macmillan did is he basically kind of pretended that nothing had happened. Then Britain could still be great. And he was able to revitalise the Conservative Party for a little while. And you could see Boris Johnson today in his speech kind of trying to do the same trick.
Which is, but even if it is, you know, it goes to the membership, and which, so the system that the Tories use, the MPs select two candidates, go to the membership. That means you're going to have a Prime Minister chosen by, what was it, 0.25% of the electorate?
Yeah, it's 150,000 people at the last count. And without wishing to be cruel about the age profile of the average Tory membership...
They're not in the first flush of youth.
Yeah, I mean, the strong chance is since the last time we had an opportunity to count them all, and some of them are, in fact, now dead. I mean, we are talking about a vanishingly small number of people.
I think the average age was 68.
Yeah, but we've had... There ought to be a rule that when you have a change of Prime Minister within an existing parliamentary term, that you have a general election automatically.
But it doesn't. Gordon Brown,
Jim Callaghan, Douglas Home, and so on and so forth. There are many examples of that happening before. I think he will be challenged. I'm not sure he can be stopped. If he gets to the final two, he wins in the membership. But will Stephen, do you think someone like Stephen Crabb could emerge as a potential challenger?
No.
No. Amber Rudd?
No.
So Theresa May or bust.
Yeah, that's there just isn't time. And also, if you're one of that younger generation, I mean, maybe if you're Amber Rudd because you've gone for him, you are a passionate pro-European, possibly you don't want to serve under Boris under any circumstances, you decide, you know, if you're going to go down, you might as well go down in flames. But why would you? You know, if you're Stephen Crabb, you're young, you're Welsh, you've built up, you know, a network of friendly journalists, and you have supporters in the parliamentary party. Why would you blow your shot by being crushed by Boris Johnson? You know,
this is also the question about whether or not you want to be the one who, in the same way that being the post-crash prime minister, whoever had come in 2010 would have probably ended up hated. Do you want to be the post-Brexit prime minister who, I mean, this is going to be a really unpleasant, turbulent period in which Britain, as you say, is going to get materially poorer, right? Is it going to grow more slowly than it would have been? There might very well be a recession. There may very well be unemployment going up.
I mean, to be honest, I'm not remotely surprised that Cameron resigned so quickly. I mean, if I was in his position, I think my strong urge would be to turn to the Brexiteers and go, well, you've broke it, you've bought it. I also think it actually is probably good for democratic norms that the prospectus that vote leave has sold the country is not something you can get from the EU. I think it's good, it's very important that Vote Leave are the people who are negotiating with the EU, because they have to be. If, when the electorate does want to punish someone, and my instinct is they will want to punish someone, I think it's important that actually the people they can punish are
other
there.
People who did it and they wanted it. Yeah.
Otherwise you have that resentment kind of...
Although that won't stop Nigel Farage, really, because he'll still be outside of the process gleefully pointing out all the problems with it. Let's turn to Labour, Jason. As we're recording this, we know that there's been a motion of no confidence tabled with Jeremy Corbyn. That will go to the PLP meeting on Monday. They will then do a straight yes, no, do you have confidence in Jeremy Corbyn as Labour leader? From your sense, is that curtains for him, or does he kind of shake him off and stagger on?
First of all, will they at the PLP vote no? They have no confidence in him. I expect they will say that. It will be a no. Wouldn't surprise me though if he fought on. He's got enormous support among the members, and he knows that. And indeed, a recent poll showed he is more popular now than he was when he won the leadership last year, so why wouldn't he stand his ground and take on whoever rises to challenge him?
Stephen, do you think that both Brexit and Jeremy Corbyn's rather lacklustre campaigning for it, or rather half-hearted campaigning for it, will have changed how Labour members feel about him? Because I have heard people who were much friendlier to him, who care about Europe and feel that he didn't put his hand to the oar. Or do you think that they forgive him almost anything?
I think yes and no. I think, based on the very unscientific metric, and if you've emailed me about coming to talk to your CLP and I haven't got back to you, I'm sorry, I'm just disorganised, but please do email me again, because you're how I... But my very unscientific metric of talking to activists out in the country, my impression is that there are people who would like not Corbyn, right? They would like... They think there are competence problems there. They think there are delivery problems there. They may think there is baggage in terms of his 30 years of association. But just as there were a large chunk of people who didn't want Cameron, but they looked at Ed Miliband and they went, actually, I think I'll stick with Cameron, I don't think that there is a politician in the parliamentary party who is more compelling to Labour activists than Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, that's that is, I think, a sober view of it. Finally, Jason, just to say, what do you think is the long term? Where do you see the country in 5 years' time?
I think it's going to be a deeply turbulent few years, possibly a recession. I think we may well see the end of the United Kingdom. Nicola Sturgeon will trigger a second Scottish referendum. And then I think we'll be in a distinctly different world from the one we are today. I think it's momentous and alarming.
Well, the one thing that is certain in an uncertain world is that the New Statesman podcast will be back next week. Thank you for joining us, Jason.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, with Stephen Bush. Our producer is India Bork, and our music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.